So this winter, on our way to Israel, very much we took a very circuitous route, Norman and I, and spent 2 months in India this winter, involved in the retreats in Bodh Gaya and in Sarnath. And oh, by the way, I heartily recommend that experience to anyone who feels a bit of adventure and has a month or two to spend. It's a wonderful experience going to India, and it's a wonderful experience going on retreat there. While we were there, you may have read about it in the newspapers or heard about it on the news. There was a terrible, terrible earthquake in Gujarat. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people were killed. It was one of the most severe earthquakes in terms of death toll, certainly in India, and I think in many other places. And it was everywhere in the news and for weeks, and very much in the hearts and minds of all of us in India, a very tragic situation. And it really brought up a lot of thoughts about what we consider to be security, what we consider to be the known. We think we know what the next minute will hold. We think we know, if we walk out the hall, what's around the next corner. But really, do we? Can we? Despite all of our plans and schedules and intentions, can we ever really know what will happen next? And reflecting on that really makes me ask, what is our expectation of tomorrow and of next week? What is it we're counting on? What is it we're relying on? In this earthquake in Gujarat, it happened in the early morning, you know, just when families were sitting around and having breakfast, getting dressed, getting ready to go to work or to school. And it affected rich and poor alike. It even, for one of the rare times in history, was even worse for the wealthy people. The poor people live in very fragile constructions, shacks really. And when the earth moves, there's not much that can there to fall in on them. So they have a much easier chance to escape than the wealthy people who are living in these huge, luxurious high-rises. And it was interesting, we heard about that in Gujarat, many of the people are very careful with their money. They're quite greedy and want to hang on to whatever they've got. And so these luxurious buildings were built in a way that sacrificed safety and sacrificed good design to provide a less expensive but more luxurious home for many, many people. And these were the people who suffered the most. I mean, just imagine what it's like to live in a very shaky, flimsy high-rise, and all of a sudden the earth moves and pshew, it all comes tumbling down. Can any of us who have never been in that situation, can we really imagine what it's like to be in an earthquake? To be waking up and sitting around drinking chai, drinking tea, and in 3 minutes, that's all it took. 3 minutes, the earth shakes. Every building crumbles. The earth opens up in 3 minutes. There's literally no place to stand. There's no place that's safe. The earth that we consider to be such a reliable support, it cracks and it opens. Where's the reliability? What we consider to be the known, the familiar, is threatened, is obliterated. And the sense of security and trust and reliability is shattered. Shelter, possessions, for some people, their whole family, their whole village, lost. I mean, we saw photographs, and just whole villages were nothing but crumbled stone. But it's interesting, in an earthquake, as in many situations in life, once the shaking and the rumbling and the cracking and the opening up is finished, we find that things settle in a different way. And also something new can be shown. And the miracle of the earthquake in Gujarat was, in the midst of all of this, new water sources found their way from deep in the earth up to the surface. And Gujarat is a desert, and it's suffered from drought for many, many years. And so here in this earthquake, which we consider to be such a tragedy, also brought another aspect. It brought the aspect of life with the water. So life is like this. When the usually reliable supports fall away, isn't it as if the earth shifts or quakes or even disappears? When our body we rely on, and when we're young and we're healthy, we just consider it's always going to be like this. When all of a sudden something in the body breaks down through illness or aging, what's the experience of that? When we get really, really ill, and things that we always assumed we could do, we no longer can do. What about with our jobs? You know, we get a job and we work at it for several years, and there's so much planning into the future based on the income from that job, the so-called security of that job, and then one day maybe it's gone. Think about this in terms of the support of relationship, whether it's parents or children or partners or siblings. Yeah, we all know that things change intellectually, but what happens when it really does, when it changes radically? And what about the whole sense of identity? Me as teacher, me as mother, me as daughter, as sister, as being a certain appearance, of as having certain abilities, whatever. And all of a sudden something comes and challenges that identity. For me, in all these situations, when that feeling that the support is gone, for me it can be like the inner light goes out because of the fear. And it really feels like having no place to stand. And what comes to mind thinking about this is the political turmoil here in Israel. The instability and the threat continuously of violence, of war, of death. And I think an earthquake may be similar to war. I've never had the experience of being directly in a war, or the kind of, you know, living in the kind of instability and threat of violence. But I think it may be an experience of places that were once safe, possibly no longer being so. Schools and buses and homes, shops, roads, all these places holding the possibility and the threat of violence and destruction and death. Death of this body, of my family, friends, people living in the country, and also the families living on the other side of the conflict. Again, as if nowhere to stand, nowhere safe. And what about when we choose to let go of the usually reliable supports in our life? Perhaps we choose to leave the security of the family to go out into the world, to travel, to go out on our own. Sometimes we choose to leave a job because it's no longer satisfying or fulfilling, or we have a sense it's not right livelihood. Or maybe we just want to change. And then there are the times we choose to leave a relationship for whatever reason. And in a way, I think of going on retreat as a time of when we choose to let go of the familiar, of what usually supports us. A retreat asks us to open to change, and it asks us to open to the tremors and the earthquakes in the body and in the mind that can accompany change, that can accompany that feeling of insecurity and the unknown. So something to reflect on is, where are the tremors and quakes here for each of you, for all of us here on the retreat or at home? Where are the opportunities to let go of the stories about those places of fear and insecurity? Where are the opportunities to let go of the holding and the expectations? Here on retreat, maybe it's the long sittings. Maybe it's the pain, or all the mind, all that the mind can show. Maybe it's standing in the food queue. Maybe it's the simplicity. Maybe it's the separation from people at home. This practice that we do asks us to open to the discomfort, to allow, to know it, to soften around it, not to resist it. So can we open to the totality of the retreat? Not just selecting the parts that we like, the parts that we want, and avoiding or being angry about the rest. I find it very interesting, and I see it in myself, how often we react to one aspect of a thing, or a person, or an event. When one aspect disappoints our expectations, doesn't that one part just get blown up so big that it seems to crowd out our perception of the whole? And all we see is what we don't like. What comes to mind is how often that happens in an argument, or when we're in pain, or when we're under stress. It's as though it fills every part of us, and we just lose touch, we lose connection with other aspects of that one thing. So I find it very interesting as well, kind of to counter that, by reflecting on the immensely broad and wide and vast range of possibility in the nature of a thing. So take a body, the body. What are the possibilities? Countless possibilities. A body can be lean, it can be slim, it can be bony, It can ache. It can be fleshy. It can be pimpled or lame, strong, hairy, flabby, upright, crooked, bent, weak, balding, sick, dying, decaying, youthful, vigorous, dead. Can be with holes. There can be pus. It can have parasites. All these things a body is. The body can be, the body may be, the body was. All of these things. And who's to say that any one of those aspects is a more correct body, a more acceptable body than another aspect? Isn't it in the nature of body to be all these things at different times, and probably more? So what is this selecting process that we do in our minds that says this body needs fixing? This needs getting rid of, or this needs changing. What expectations of this body are we bringing here to the sittings, to the walkings, to the standing meditation, to the meal times? Take an object, a cup. So what is a cup? It can be whole. It can have a big crack in it. It can be broken. It can be crushed into dust. It can be used to hold drinks. It can be used to hold food or paint or dirt. If a cup breaks, how can we be surprised? How can we be angry? Isn't it as much in the nature of cup to be broken as it is to be whole? Doesn't the life of a cup also include the death of a cup? Take a relationship. Can't it also be whole or cracked and broken, satisfying, calm, harmonious, angry, exclusive, open? And a retreat can be all those things too. Whole, cracked, broken, satisfying, calm, harmonious, angry, exclusive, open. The problem isn't really out there with that thing when it breaks, or with that person, or with a sitting when they disappoint or they make us angry. And sometimes they make us really angry. Things are as they are, and they change. So I think what this points to, instead of looking out there to solve a problem, looking out there at any of these things, can we look at it in a different way? Can we instead open to something in all its manifestations, in its wholeness, in any of its forms? Can we open to the broken bits, to the angry bits? Can we bring interest and mindfulness and openness to the experience of just this? To know it wholeheartedly, just as it is, accepting that whole range of suchness, whether it's suchness of a thing or a person, pimples and all, holes and all, weaknesses and all, And can we bring openness and interest and honesty to whatever our reactions might be? If there's a reaction with a, if something happens and there's a strong negative reaction, can we respond by asking, okay, where's the holding? Is there attachment to an ideal, to just one aspect of this thing? And also with a strong positive reaction, when there's a real sense of pleasure and enjoyment, also asking, is there holding? Is there an attachment to some ideal, some idea? With all these reactions and all these responses, can we accept and know them wholeheartedly, allowing opening to ourselves and to our mind states and emotions, and opening to others as well, allowing the experience of discomfort and knowing it in body and mind, knowing it as dukkha, which Norman talked about last night, and knowing the cause of dukkha as the holding, the attaching to, the pushing away, the tightening around. But also knowing that with the opening to, the allowing, as the grip loosens, then we also can know the ending of dukkha. Ajahn Suchito is a monk who is based in England, and he said something that really touched me. The sensory world is something that you use and practice with. You have to go and give a talk, for instance, and you don't know what to say. So you just use that as a way of making peace with that feeling of inadequacy. You always use the inadequacies of the body and mind and the sensory experience to develop something that will balance them out, bringing forth patience when there's restlessness, love when there's aversion, tolerance when there's prejudice, responding rather than reacting. So you find the very limitations of life are continually making you fuller and richer, because you make up for those limitations by the presence of the spirit, by the presence of the awareness of the mind. It's beautiful. So what happens when we can open the heart to what is, to however it is or however I am, rather than tightening in aversion? Can we welcome this edge of not knowing, this edge of not judging, even reacting and confusion, as the place that transformation can happen? Are you familiar with the symbol of the Tao, the yin-yang symbol, the circle with the squiggle and half is black and half is white, and there's a dot of the black in the white, and there's a dot of the white in the black. So the seed of one is in the other. The seed of its opposite is always present. So to me, this points to and it illustrates totality. It illustrates wholeness. It illustrates non-duality, non-separation. The totality of a thing, of a person, of life. And I think we can see lots of examples of that. You know, this impermanent, changing nature of life and of all things reveal this. A lotus grows out of the mud. Confusion gives way to understanding. We're patient. Darkness eases into light, and then back again to darkness. And understanding gives way again to confusion. And a lotus dies and decays and returns again to the mud. So can we be steady with understanding and remembering the nature of things? Can we trust the darkness and the confusion and the mud? Can we open to the darkness as a source of the light? Just open to that possibility. Personally, I can relate to what Ajahn Suchito said about giving a talk. He was specifically talking about giving a Dharma talk. And for me, giving a talk can sometimes feel like jumping off a cliff into darkness. Or jumping off a cliff into deep water. And sometimes there's a sense, you know, I walk into the hall and I sit down on the cushion, and it's like, okay, the waters are there, and I hold my nose and I say a prayer and I close my eyes and I jump. I just I feel incredible sensations in my body, fear, and the mind thinks up every reason not to do this, but I jump in spite of it all. Partly because you're all out there and there's no choice. But each time, it really is an opportunity to cultivate trust, to cultivate acceptance of the fear, of the emotions, of the uncertainty, of the insecurity, to plumb the depths of feeling the doubt and the expectations that I have, that I put on myself. And I think it's true, it can be true for each of us here. Just looking at, seeing where's the holding in whatever aspect of our life it shows itself. And seeing it as an opportunity to investigate. To see and know that it's just a habit of mind, it's a tendency. A tendency of grasping onto this identity. I'm up here, I've got to sound good, I've got to do good. Or aversion, pushing away. I don't want to look like an idiot. That sense of inadequacy. Really seeing and knowing dukkha and its cause, and then the ending of dukkha. When you jump. And this can happen for each of us in each sitting, in each reaction to somebody here, to the food, to the weather, to the teachers, whatever. And I also think it's really good to look at what is our attitude just to mindfulness. What kind of holding is there around that? It's very important in revealing. During a sitting, do we tighten up with effort? Or do we relax and open? So, one of the things I've been noticing is that when the sense of body changes from pleasant or neutral to unpleasant, all of a sudden, there's a sense of poor me. It's very different from the sense of, this is just what the body feels like now, which is easy to say when we're feeling good, right? But when there's unpleasantness, somehow there's an identifying with it. There's an ownership that springs to life. Full of this delusion that it's me that it's mine, that it's I. But really, isn't this just the nature of body? You know, right now, this is just a nose being a nose, which in this case, in fact, for 2 days has been very itchy when I sit on this chair because of the flowers around. Or maybe it's, this is a knee. It's just a knee being a knee. It just happens to have sharp sensations sometimes. And this mind, this busy, busy mind, full of judgment, full of thoughts, or else calm, at ease, whichever moment. Maybe instead we can just see this as nose affected by the flowers, knee affected by sitting for so long, mind affected by whatever, my having to give a talk. Kind of depersonalizes a bit, doesn't it? It just cuts through that sense, this is my knee and my dukkha and my problem and my suffering. This is seeing and understanding the non-self of it, which means the non-separateness of it. It's not the nose all by itself. It's not my nose. It's the nose and the flowers. It's not to deny that this is a body and that it was born so many years ago and it's called Peggy. You know, it's really here. I am here. But it's the non-separateness of it, of things. So at the end of a sitting, a good question to ask yourself, to reflect on, is how are you feeling? How were you feeling during the meditation, and how are you feeling when you get up and walk out of the hall? Is there a feeling of struggle, or was there a feeling of struggle during the sitting? Does it feel like a battleground? Is there tightness? Do you feel tightness in the body or in the mind? And how much of that is because of identifying, taking up, holding, pushing away whatever was going on during that time? Wherever you are in the moment, in the practice, is the practice. Not something to get rid of. Don't wish it away so you can be with the breath. Let it be the door to the practice. One of my teachers said this, and it really, really touched me. I'd like to say it one more time. Wherever you are in the moment, in the practice, is the practice. Not something that you have to get rid of first. Don't wish it away so you can be with the breath. Let it be the door to the practice. So can we just now relax into this moment and what it holds? Meeting it with awareness, with pure presence. Can we experience the calmness and the inner joy, this state that doesn't ask for anything, that's not dependent on having anything special or being anything special? This state that is non-grasping, non-clinging, and not involved with me, or I, or my, or mine. My sense of calmness and inner joy is that it just rests, it just lives in that place of meeting the here and now. The teachings of liberation are opportunities for liberation, for freedom. They're pointers to it. Can we just for a moment consider that we're already free? We're whole just as we are. And it's just our senses and our minds that convince us otherwise. So I encourage us to use this precious time together to let something else show, to let something else be revealed that isn't limited by our small view of things, that isn't conditioned, that isn't dependent on something or someone being any special way. So let's sit quietly together for a few minutes.